A number of events that have happened during the week that could have a substantial impact upon your liberty and freedoms. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle and Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is our co-host, my Vice Chairman, good friend, and fellow analyst, Chuck Michaels.
Yeah, Barry, and it's good to be here. Good to be talking about this subject because this is a very disturbing thing to me, and I know it is to you, too.
It is. Well, it seems that this week, Charles, this preceding week, the collective mind of the country has been totally lost. And no, it wasn't because of Barack Obama's State of the Union message the other night. It's because of some of the actions, both of the courts and of some federal agencies, which tend to have a chilling effect on our liberties, at the very least. And for some people, including the person we're going to talk about next, had a direct impact on their freedom and liberty. For those of you who are new to what we're doing here, we're going to be talking about a lot of issues, a lot of activities and events that have been happening in our country, and we're going to be looking at it from a constitutional perspective. Now, I think this is very interesting because our first little tidbit we've got today, Charles, has to do with at what point does an executive branch agency have the ability to violate Article 1, Section 6 of the United States Constitution?
Well, they don't have any authority to violate Article 1, Section 6 of the United States Constitution because the language is very explicit.
Well, you're right about that. Now, for those of you who are sitting there saying, hey, I don't have my pocket constitution with me, what does Article 1, Section 6 say? Well, let me just put it to you this way. What we had this week, and I think this happened on Monday of this week, was a United States senator from the state of Kentucky by the name of Rand Paul. You might sound a little bit familiar because his father, Ron Paul, is a congressman from Texas who's running for the Republican nomination for president. Well, Senator Rand Paul was on his way to a session of the United States Senate, and he lives in Kentucky, so he usually flies out of Kentucky. Well, his flight path took him into Nashville. And so at the Nashville airport, he was getting ready to board a flight to go to the United States Senate, to fly into Washington, D.C. Now, I don't know which airport he was flying into. It really doesn't matter. But the whole thing was, is as he went through the security screening checkpoint, things got a little interesting. Now, Chuck, I'm going to let you kind of explain what happened, and then we'll talk about why Article 1, Section 6 applies in this matter.
Well, apparently what happened was there was some kind of an equipment glitch when Paul went through the metal detector. And so they pulled him aside and told him he would have to submit to a pat down.
Which is a body search.
And essentially, Paul said, no, I will not take a pat down. I will pass through the metal detector again once you have it operating correctly.
Yes, because obviously they can't really, number one, they can't continue to use that particular detector if it has a problem. And number two, they can't just necessarily, maybe they would think they could actually do a body search on every passenger that came through that particular section of the line until they got it fixed. So I believe that Paul's response was valid. He was more than willing to cooperate with them up to a point.
Right. And that's the whole point. The TSA has a rule that once there's a problem, then no one can pass through until there's a resolution of the problem. And I grasp that. But in fact, what they've turned that into, as usual with bureaucrats who grasp at straws of power, they've decided that once their equipment fails, that means that they get to pick and choose what method they use to screen you with.
And yes, and probably there's something in the Patriot Act that allows them to get away with that. Another piece of unconstitutional legislation.
That's right. That
the legal fiction is that it's the law of the land. But what we've got here is that the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, which is a division of the Department of Homeland Security, which is an executive branch agency under the executive section of the Constitution, so the president's cabinet level and on down, so these are like a subhead of a subhead of a subhead, they've decided that because of their preeminence from the executive branch, that they have the right to do to anyone, because remember, what is the executive branch of government for? It's to enforce the laws of the United States.
Right.
They believe that they're enforcing the law of the United States, and we can talk all day long about whether the Patriot Act is actually the law of the United States, is it constitutional or not. But the point is that they've taken that charge so far that they believe that they can violate other sections of the United States Constitution in doing that particular task.
And that's the problem that you run into when you write nebulous laws, laws that are deliberately vague, sort of like the Internal Revenue Code, the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, the Enemy Expatriation Act, which have deliberately vague phraseology so that members of the executive branch can feel free to expand power however they feel necessary. Ladies and gentlemen, that was what it was written to prevent.
Oh, absolutely. But see, that's the whole thing. We now live in an era where our officials believe that that document, the United States Constitution, is a helpful list of suggestions and not a directive on what they can and can't do.
That's right.
And Article 1, Section 6, as we're talking about now, granted, ladies and gentlemen, if this same issue happened to you and me, who are not federal officials, who are not members of Congress, this wouldn't apply to us. But the same idea, the same lack of wanting to have somebody physically invade your personal space and actually treat you as somebody who's being detained as a legal threat, well, I can see where Senator Paul had a little problem with that. I would have a major problem with that.
Yeah.
But this hasn't stopped the TSA before. We've heard about a number of horror stories, everything from elderly people in walkers to paraplegics in wheelchairs to little children who are getting full body searches because for some reason their screening mechanisms went off when this person passed the detector.
Right.
Now, the funny part about it is, I've read more into this, Chuck, the area of concern that they were targeting in on Rand Paul was his knee. Now, Paul, it says, I've never had any kind of knee surgery or any kind of medical implant ever put into either knee. So for some reason, this thing went off and detected metal around his knee. I think that would be fairly easy to, hey, can you pull your pants up? We need to look at your knee a little bit and scan. Okay, you haven't had any pins or anything. There's nothing here. Scan it with a wand. Let the guy go on. No, what did the TSA do? They detained him, telling him he'd have to submit to a body search.
Yeah.
Which he refused to do because he thinks that that's onerous. Then they put him into a glass cubicle, and there's a video up, if you can go, and Google it up.
We'll post it. If it's on YouTube, we'll post it.
It's not much, but you see Senator Paul sitting in this cubicle on his cell phone with a dark-jacketed TSA official standing over him, hovering with his hands behind his back, looking at him, and then looking away for a second, and looking back down at him, as if he were going to do something, terroristic, while sitting there in a cubicle being detained and missing his flight.
A United States Senator.
A United States Senator. Now, that brings us to the reason why the TSA is totally in the wrong in this case. Chuck, what does Article 1, Section 6 actually say?
All right. Article 1, Section 6, the relevant section, says, this is of all members of the House and Senate. They shall, in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place.
Okay, we see Article 1, Section 6, ladies and gentlemen, spells out that members of Congress cannot be detained from doing their job, from going to and coming from sessions of their respective chambers. As we mentioned earlier, Senator Paul was in Nashville flying to D.C. because there was a called session of the United States Senate that he was coming into. So he was in pursuit of doing his job. Now, what's happened here is the TSA got very defensive about this because it became a very hot news story very quickly. Because really of who it was. If this had been any other United States senator, it probably would have passed with less fanfare.
Well, let me give you, for instance,
okay,
something like this happened to Ted Kennedy.
Yes.
While he was alive and a serving U.S. senator. And he was very quickly passed through, allowed to get wanded, or I think passed through the metal detector, put on a plane, and off he went.
Exactly. But you see, Senator Paul has... I guess, distinguished himself in the United States Senate, especially on committees where they have oversight of the Department of Homeland Security and oversight of the Transportation Security Administration. That's Senator Paul, I guess, earlier in the summer, took the head of the TSA to significant task because of a similar search and pat down that the TSA performed on a six-year-old girl who happened to be one of Senator Paul's constituents.
I think that they, rather than saying he took significant issue with it, he took him to the woodshed.
Yeah, well, I was being kind. But
I've seen the video, and if I can find it, we'll post that as well. And you're probably right. That is probably why this is an exercise of raw naked power. The TSA believes that they are above constitutional law. Because, well, let's face it, their entire agency violates constitutional law, and therefore, since they're illegal already, why not, as Patrick Henry said, if this be treason, let's make the most of it. If this be unconstitutional, well, let's make the most of it. What's interesting about this entire case is who came out immediately and backed the Transportation Safety Administration.
That would be the Obama administration, President Obama. That White House came out and basically gave carte blanche to the TSA to do whatever they felt like. Now, Chuck, honestly, if we read carefully into Article 1, Section 6,
right,
the only thing that they could possibly hang their actions upon to try to give them legitimacy would be that Senator Paul was, quote-unquote, breaching the peace.
Right.
However, the news agencies in our country did something very smart. They requested FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, the videos from the security area, which showed Senator Paul being very calm, very
cooperative
up to a point. When he said, no, I'm not going to let you pat me down, we'll go back through the scanner, that's fine. But the point is, when they reported that he was an irate passenger, and they had to detain, first of all, they said, well, we never detained him, but the video shows he's in this cubicle with somebody standing over him, watching him on guard. That's not freedom of movement.
No, it is not.
He didn't have any ability to walk out. If he'd have walked out of there, they would have had him on the ground with his hands behind his back, strapped down with plastic straps, and then there would have been a full body, including a cavity search, probably.
Might have been a taser involved.
A taser involved as well.
Well, let's talk about why that particular set. A lot of people might look at that section in the Constitution and say, why is that there? Now, once you understand why that's there, then you'll understand why the White House reaction with the current occupant is the way it was. Let me give you a for instance. I have a friend whose father was a North Dakota legislator.
Okay.
State legislator. I don't remember if he served in the House or the Senate, but it doesn't really matter.
That wouldn't happen to have been Larry Wywoody, would it?
No, it would not.
Okay. I've heard some stories about that one too.
What basically happened was this fellow, they had a session of the legislature coming up, and he had to get there, and he lived in, I forget where they lived, and Dickinson, and the legislature sits in Bismarck, so he had to get there, and he had to be there by a certain time. So he got in his car, and the head of whatever house it was said, get here, we don't care, be here by this time. So he gets in the car, and he's speeding, and he's probably doing about 85 miles an hour or something, and he gets pulled over by the North Dakota Highway Patrol.
Of course.
And who arrests him? It's like, you can't arrest me because I'm on my way to a session of the legislature. And the guy says, I can arrest you for anything. Again, this is an executive branch official who doesn't understand his duty. So he immediately was taken to the station. He was given the phone, and he called the head of whichever house. And that person said, put the person who arrested you and the sergeant at the desk on the phone. So what happened was these two guys got on the phone and they said, you will release him immediately. And not only that, you will escort him to the state house. The North Dakota Constitution is very clear on this. A sitting and elective office holder cannot be detained while he is on his way to a session. Now, let's say he was shooting signs out the window at 85 miles an hour, he's saying, hey, let's see if I can hit a road sign with my 357 and that I'm illegally carrying in my car.
Yeah, I think that that's a common practice in North Dakota.
That's right. Well, that's one of the state tree is a road sign with holes in it. So I had a friend tell me that once. But no, but the whole point is that would be a breach of the peace.
Yes, it would.
Merely speeding to get to where you're going is not a breach of the peace. Now, if Rand Paul had been pulled off his hip piece and was firing through the roof of the airport or taking pot shots at artwork in there.
Absolutely.
Definitely breach of the peace.
Absolutely.
Refusing to take a pat down.
Not so much.
Rather than a go through it, be wanded, or go back through the metal detector. Now, that's not a breach of the peace.
Now, let's also remember this, folks. For those of you who've not flown in the last few years that we've had this monstrosity called the TSA, he's standing in line with no shoes on, no belt on, nothing in his pockets. I'm surprised that he had his cell phone, so it must have been once he stepped through, he picked it up or he requested it because he had a cell phone he could make some phone calls with. And that's how he basically called his office and that's how the story got out was somebody on his staff tweeted, you know, the senator's being detained at the Nashville airport for refusing a pat down. And that's how this whole thing got started. But the point is, Chuck, the TSA and the White House are saying, hey, we're well on the right. And I think it's because they're going to play fast and loose. They're going to play postmodernist with the definition of a particular word. That particular word being arrest. They're going to say that we never arrested him. We don't have arrest powers. We just detained him. We just escorted him to a secure area and put guards over him. But we did not arrest him. And what they're going to do is they're going to try to hang on the fact that people don't understand that there are multiple definitions to the word arrest and that you have to go back and look at how the founders believed it to be used and what its definition was in order to understand what they meant. They mean detained.
Well, that's sort of like someone saying you shook that person. You took him by the elbow, by the shoulders and shook him. No, I gently grasped them by their upper body and made slight oscillating movements back and forth. I wouldn't call that a shaking. I was just oscillating that person. No, you shook them. Detaining is the same as being arrested. If you can't leave, you're under arrest.
Regardless of whether or not the quote-unquote detaining entity has arrest powers or not. And it's interesting because at the conclusion of this, after quite a bit of time, and I don't know how long it was, but it was long enough that Rand Paul missed his flight.
Details are scarce.
Are sketchy in this. But long enough that he missed his flight that the TSA had to go and get local law enforcement to come and escort him to his next flight. So the point is, they don't have arrest powers, but the definition in Article 1, Section 6 is broader than just someone who's a sworn peace officer of the law putting you in handcuffs or putting you behind bars.
If you want to know what probably happened with the escort, that was probably ordered either by the Senate majority or the Senate minority leader.
Very well could have been to say, you are going to make sure that you get the senator on a flight and get him here.
That's right. That would be my speculation as to what happened there. Because once Paul calls the leadership of the Senate, it is the Senate leadership's duty, whether they like him or not. And I can assure you that both the majority leader, who is Harry Reid, and the minority leader, who is Mitch McConnell,
who happens to be the senior senator from Kentucky,
and does not like Rand Paul in the slightest.
Well, at least we see that in a lot of the back and forth that we see between those two, yes.
But the fact is, they have a duty to make certain, and I'm willing to bet dollars to donuts, as my mother used to say, that Paul was escorted there by local police officers by order of Senate leadership.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt that a bit. But see, ladies and gentlemen, that's the whole point. The Constitution is there not just to protect you and I from runaway law. It's even to protect those who make the laws from somebody who would trample on them willy-nilly saying, well, we've got the authority because it's a matter of national security.
Well, we were going to talk about why that's there.
Yes.
Okay, now we've given the examples. Now, why is it there? Well, during English history, very often the king would want a certain piece of legislation to pass through Parliament.
Oh, yes.
Especially the House of Commons. The lords he pretty much had in his pocket.
But yes, because he could grant titles or lands to them.
He could pack the House of Lords. He couldn't pack the Commons. He could do it, but he couldn't pack it as easily. So basically what he would do was, in some cases, if things looked a little close or if somebody was saying things that he didn't consider to be very nice, he would have members of Parliament detained, if you will, or as we've just explained, actually arrested.
Yes.
Parliament, during the revolutionary period, passed what they called their Bill of Rights, and I wouldn't swear to this, but I think this got added to the British Constitution, which is an unwritten document. It's a body of law. During the revolutionary period, and that is that the king or anybody cannot arrest a parliamentarian as he is on his way or while he's sitting
in the parliament.
So it doesn't matter what is said on the floor of Parliament. It doesn't matter what he's doing unless he's committing a breach of the peace, speaking treason, committing a felony.
Yes. Yeah.
Again, that has a specific definition as well. So we now see that the reason that that is in a part of our Constitution, it was handed down, and they saw the utility of this hand down to keep things like perhaps the executive branch from attempting to stack the deck in the House of Representatives or in the Senate and by arresting sitting members of the House or the Senate. So it's not legal. Well, why would President Barack Obama suddenly all come out and be all TSA is A-OK, anything they say goes? I mean, it was essentially, it was a rah-rah, sis-boom-bah, the pom-poms going back and forth while yay, yay, TSA. Why would he take that attitude? I think it becomes rather obvious when you look at it, the reason why it's there, why he would take that attitude.
Well, obviously, if you had a situation where you knew a vote was coming up, something you really wanted, there's a possibility. Now, I'm not saying that he would do this, but there is a possibility that the ability would be there to make contact through your Department of Homeland Security to say, if so, these particular people come through your airport, stop them and hold them.
Yeah, or make up a story. You at some point, there are all kinds of ways to do this.
Yes, there are.
But the fact is that you could very easily gum up the legislative works, stop a filibuster, you could stop certain legislation from being passed that had a deadline, you know, vetoes from being overridden by stopping people from being able to travel to the houses of Congress to do their job. And therefore, now you understand, I think, the motivation behind the President of the United States, who basically covets all power to himself. He wants the right to be able to dictate. He's said as much. This is not something I'm making up. I mean, he has basically said recently that because Congress is not cooperating, he'll just figure out a way to do it on his own, and this is one of the ways he would do it on his own. So it's easy to see why, constitutionally, this is there, and why the president wants the power to ignore that particular section.
And that's the reason why the Constitution matters.
That's right.
And why we teach Institute on the Constitution, and why you should be paying attention at our website at principlepolicy.com when we announce classes coming up on Institute on the Constitution, because you'll learn about how to utilize that document to protect yourself. Now, granted, you're not a member of Congress. Most of you aren't. But even so, there are rights that we have as citizens granted to us in the Bill of Rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. We have some Fourth Amendment rights. Those are some things that we need to make sure that we're aware of, that we understand why they're there, and how we can best utilize those things to protect our liberties. I believe Senator Rand Paul is probably going to be having quite a few contentious hearings with the TSA in the near future as the Senate reconvenes.
If I were the head of the TSA and some of the people who detained Rand Paul, I think I would be looking for the subpoenas to arrive for the hearings rather quickly. And that being said, you know, Barry, this particular form of lawlessness, and the fact is, whether people think about it in these terms or not, this is a Christian worldview issue, whether people think so or not. It is. Words mean things. The Constitution is there to restrict the government, and people say, what's that have to do with Christianity? Well, the fact is that our rights come from God, and the purpose of the government is to protect those rights. And the fact is that what is being done is those rights that God has given us are slowly being taken away and centralized, not only by the federal, but the state governments and even the local governments are getting involved. In fact, I saw an article today that basically says, and if you'll recall, we brought this up in a program, Barry and I discussed how Barack Obama would use the local police forces. He would federalize them rather than use the army to detain American citizens. And in fact, what this article shows is that plan is underway, that every police force would have to have a liaison with the Department of Homeland Security sitting in an office in your local police department, your local sheriff's office, your local constable's office. They will at least have to be trained, and they would have to report to some kind of a federal liaison. So, folks, these things are not something that we're not going fantasy land here. These are the reality. And a lot of Christians have been suckered into the idea that because these guys are, quote unquote, trying to make us safe, it's all okay. Well, this is the old thing about trading liberty for safety.
For a little temporary, we trade permanent liberty for a little temporary security.
Right.
We deserve neither liberty nor security.
That's right. We trade precious liberty for a little temporary security, and we deserve neither liberty nor security. It's Benjamin Franklin, 1759. Okay, so what other breaches of the law have we seen? Well, we spent, what, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks talking about the National Defense Authorization Act, which is part and parcel of this. The Enemy Expatriation Act. Now we see the federal courts jumping in. Now, I have in front of me a story from CNN.com wherein a judge ordered a defendant who was under investigation. The federal government is preparing to prosecute this person. A judge has ordered this person to decrypt an encrypted computer.
Yes.
That the government says contains a lot of data that they need to prosecute this person. Now, listen to this. Remember that we have the Fifth Amendment right to not testify against ourselves.
That's
we
right.
have the right to not incriminate ourselves. It's very clear in Article 5, we don't have to testify. We don't have to provide any kind of evidence against ourselves at all. All right. Listen to a quote from this judge's order, ordering this woman to decrypt this computer.
Yes.
Quote, I conclude that the Fifth Amendment is not implicated by requiring production of the encrypted contents of the Toshiba Satellite M305 laptop computer.
Hey, that's the one I've got. I've got a Toshiba Satellite M305. Hey, she knows how to pick computers.
That's
I'll just tell
right.
you that right
sure.
now. Now, I don't know if mine's encrypted or not, so if anybody wants to try to hack me, that's fine. But Chuck, this is the whole issue, because if you take this and think about it, now, of course, they try to set this up that it's a case of bank fraud.
Right.
And so, therefore, they must get these files on this computer. What would law enforcement have to do if it happened to be something locked in the trunk of a car or in a safe deposit box or any place else that, because all this is a computer software that's locked down.
Yes.
Somebody has locked it for their privacy's sake. It's no different than me locking my house.
What it is.
Can the Fifth Amendment not apply if the cops come busting into my house and open my safe and find documents in there?
Well, yeah, it's an unpickable lock.
Right.
It's an unpickable lock and one that cannot be cut off. Now, what has been done here is what they call 128-bit encryption. And the fact is, no software exists currently that can break certain kinds of encryption. And the government knows this. And here's what the government prosecutors argued. Now, talk about weak. The government had argued that there was no Fifth Amendment breach and that it might, quote, require significant resources and may harm the subject computer, quote, end quote, if the authorities tried to crack the encryption. In other words, we can't get into this thing without busting it.
Well, number one, they said it's going to cost us some money to do this if we can do
it. Lots of money.
It's going to cost us lots of money. And number two, we might lose what we think we can use as evidence against her.
Right.
Which gets back to the Fifth Amendment. That whole idea against self-incrimination. Now, Charles, you know, I would hope that between us and our listeners, none of us would have anything on our computer hard drives that would incriminate us legally in regard to anything. So I would believe that most people would say, they would think about this. Well, you know what? That's fine. But the point is, what if she, even if she or anybody else out there, put yourself in this position. What if you worked for a company or you were an entrepreneur and you had patents in there, you had copyrightable material, you had designs that you were working on that were proprietary, things that you don't want people to see or that you have a fiduciary interest in keeping private.
Now, I'm going to quote to you from memory, but there is such a case already. And the fact is that somebody was using 128-bit encryption
mm-hmm.
and using a password that wasn't words. It was all symbols and numbers and random things. The guy memorized it, apparently. You know, he's a genius
sure.
or something. And if you've ever seen a 128-bit password, it's not a couple of letters. It's long.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big dude. Okay. So what happened was the government seized this guy's computer and took it in, and they were going to prosecute him on the basis of what they found in it. And 2 years later, they returned his laptop computer undecrypted and finally said, okay, we
can't
get it open.
Can't do it.
Well, listen, this is obviously what this prosecutor had in mind, because Assistant U.S. Attorney Patricia Davies said in a court filing that if Judge Blackburn did not rule against the woman, that would amount to a, quote, concession to her and potential criminals, in parentheses, be it in child exploitation, national security, terrorism, financial crimes, or drug trafficking cases, in parentheses, that encrypting all inculpatory digital evidence will serve to defeat the efforts of law enforcement officers to obtain such evidence through judicially authorized search warrants, and thus make their prosecution impossible. In other words, these people have to be required to testify against themselves so we can convict them of these crimes.
Well, first and foremost, from what I understand from the materials that we've seen about this, the reason why they're trying to build a case against her, but they cannot build the case unless they can go in and seize material in her hard drive that they can then use to help build their prosecution. In other words, they're not sure what they're stabbing at, but they're going to grab everything they can grab and then try to jigsaw framework a case out of it.
Well, okay, what you've exposed is the very reason, and I'm going to go to a section of the Constitution, I'm going to read it.
And that's what we need to do.
The right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported mm-hmm. by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched, and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, you have to have something.
Yes.
Some piece of information in order to actually get the things that you want in a search warrant. It essentially looked like they got, very often, they have some kind of nebulous thing. Very often, there you can get a magistrate. Ask anybody who has been involved in getting search warrants issued, and sometimes you get judges who will sign search warrants or magistrates that will sign search warrants on next to nothing.
Oh, yes.
Very
absolutely.
Next to nothing. So basically, in violation of the Constitution, by the way, because it says specifically, you got to lay it out. What have you got? Have you got probable cause? This looks to me like they went on a fishing expedition. No fish would take the worm. And so they're therefore saying, we need to pull this fish up, shove the worm down its throat, and then cut him open and see what's inside.
You're always so graphic about these things, Charles. I love it. But the whole point is, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't matter at this point whether the defendant, whose name is Ramona Fracosu, is guilty or not of the charges that they're trying to bring against her. The whole point is, we have a presumption in this country of what? Of being innocent until proven guilty. part of the reason for the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution was to keep specious charges from being brought against somebody by going in and digging around, because this used to happen during the period going all the way back to the Inquisition,
right,
to the period of the monarchs in England, where they would come in, they would arrest somebody for some slight, then they would go through every personal paper, letter that they'd ever written, and they'd build a case around that to charge them with treason.
Yes, and or pass a bill of attainder.
Or pass a bill of attainder, yeah, which they're prevented from doing now, yes, today. But the key is, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't really matter whether or not this lady is guilty or not of the charges that are being brought against her. The whole point is that United States District Judge Robert Blackburn in Colorado has now said the Fifth Amendment only applies when we want it to.
Right.
So in other words, they're saying we can use all of these excuses. And honestly, Chuck, some of these things, I'm sure all of us would say, well, you know, that's a tough one to wrestle with. Child exploitation. Nobody wants to see children being exploited in any way, shape, or form. But the point is that, Charles, they're already doing it, and there have probably been cases where they've been able to get at it with other means other than decrypting things.
Well, as we've spoken of in the past, this is an emotional appeal, Barry.
Oh, it is an emotional appeal.
This was child pornography, child exploitation, national security, terrorism, financial crimes, or drug trafficking cases.
That's right.
All of which are immediately, you know, pop something into the hearer's head about, oh, you know, bad guy. The fact is, if the person has committed some form of bank fraud, there should be other evidence besides that they should be able to prosecute without the contents of this computer. If you've got a bunker, okay, and the judge issues a search warrant, and they can't get into the bunker, too bad. Sorry, you either got to figure out a way to get into the bunker or do the job without the contents of the bunker.
Because our presumption in law is a person is innocent until proven guilty.
That's right.
By a court of law. Now, but the key is, I do believe that this is going to be an interesting test. We've already had a situation where the Fourth Amendment has been trampled upon because law enforcement has a quote-unquote prior need or pressing need in order to get at a suspect without going through the machinery of, right, getting a search warrant to start with. Now are we going to say that prosecutors now can use any of these excuses to get at somebody, to get at somebody's Fifth Amendment rights because they've been able to present a compelling emotional case that, well, if we don't get all this information, if I can't get down there and find out, you know, the defendant's underwear size and preferred brand, we can't make this prosecution stick. Well, you know what? That is part of the reason. We have to balance the fact that we will have situations where people are going to be creative and break law, but there are other means of getting them to, right, justice.
Right.
Without destroying the constitutional protections that benefit all of us. You see, if we sit back and say, well, yeah, that judge is right, you know, she's a bad character, and so therefore the Fifth Amendment shouldn't apply in her case, how soon, ladies and gentlemen, before some situation could occur where maybe the Fifth Amendment won't apply in your case either?
And that's the whole point, Barry, because once these rights don't apply in certain types of cases, and that's the whole idea, the whole reason that the National Defense Authorization Act and the Enemy Expatriation Act are really terrible, because they violate the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment and the Seventh and the Eighth. And the fact is, once those are gone for one era, well, we're only doing this for national security and terrorism. Wait a minute. Because courts have never, ever not expanded those into other things. Once you breach the wall, the hole in the wall is there, and it only gets bigger. It's like, you know, the kid who stuck his finger in the dike. If he took his finger out, what became a little squirt, a little leak, in an hour or two suddenly is 300 gallons a minute. And pretty soon the whole dike is breached. And that's exactly what happens, because the hole never gets smaller. The hole only gets bigger.
Or the hole gets patched with something that causes something to fall apart somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
And that's what's happened, because the United States Supreme Court, Chuck, Beyond this, this is the Colorado District Court, but the U.S. Supreme Court has been a little schizophrenic on the Fourth Amendment. We've talked in the past about the issue of Ford versus Kentucky, the case where they were chasing, they'd set up a drug deal. The guy bought the drugs, and then they called in the cops to come and arrest him, but he took off on them and ran into a set of apartments and ran into an apartment.
Right.
The cops come busting down. They knock on the door. They hear what they say is the sound of evidence being destroyed. How they could get that, I don't know.
Right.
Kick the door in and arrest this gentleman and his girlfriend who owned the apartment and another guy because they had drug paraphernalia. They were smoking marijuana, and there's cocaine and everything in the house. But he was the wrong guy. It wasn't their suspect. The court ruled, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that they didn't have, when they were in pursuit like that, or they felt it was necessary, they didn't have to have a warrant. But here just the last week, actually this last week, the United States Supreme Court came down in a decision that, even though they were divided in their reasoning on it, basically was a unanimous decision that if law enforcement puts a tracking device on a suspect's vehicle.
The GPS decision.
It was a GPS on a suspected drug dealer. They put a GPS unknowingly on his car to track him to see if they could get him dealing drugs, and they did. But the point is that the courts have said, you know what? You didn't have a warrant to put that device on his car. And so therefore, the conviction's overturned. Interesting. If they were just chasing the guy from a drug deal, they could do whatever they felt like, including busting into somebody else's house and arresting them.
The wrong person's house, yeah.
But if they actually had set it up where they were monitoring and tracking this guy, then no, you have to have a warrant. So the point is our problem is even the United States Supreme Court right now is not consistent on how they follow the law. I will say one thing. They did get this case right technically.
Yes, they did.
Because the Fourth Amendment is very clear about the fact that you have to have a warrant. It has to be specific about what you're going after, and it has to be so you have to get it from a judge and who takes a look at your logic and reasoning as law enforcement says, yeah, okay, that's permissible, versus what they've done and what they might do to the Fifth Amendment in dealing with this case coming out of Colorado. We would hope that the court would remain on the side, or at least start to get over to the side of defending the Constitution's provisions.
You'd hope. But I don't hold out much hope, Barry, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm looking at this whole discussion leads me into another thing, another story that you and I wanted to get to today.
Yes.
And it actually segues very well into it, because We are watching the general lawlessness of the government, and what's happening is they are beginning to build a case for martial law.
Yes.
And you and I both happened to catch this little interview, and it's really kind of an attempt at a puff piece, which I'm really sort of shocked at. How you can make a puff piece on this guy, I don't know. But it's about George Soros.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we know he's the boogeyman and all that. Well, he really is kind of the boogeyman. He's a bad guy. This is a man who has made fortunes and increased his own personal power by crashing currencies. In fact, he's crashed several
countries' entire financial
systems. And in fact, he almost crashed Great Britain's entire banking system.
And not too long ago.
No.
Either.
Now, this is a guy, it just came to my attention that when John Kerry was running for president, one of the candidates that he was floating as Secretary of State was George Soros.
Maybe this calls for an amendment that we can get our elected officials to put forward to say that not only should the president be a natural-born citizen, maybe the cabinet officials should be natural-born citizens.
Yeah, that's been tried. And
I know, it doesn't work. I'm just
kidding.
Yeah,
there was an attempt to, there were one of the reasons, there was a guy named Albert Gallatin.
Gallatin, that's right.
Who apparently the Jefferson wing that wanted to get elected, I think, and everybody else in the Whigs said no. well, it turned out he was not born in the United States. So,
that's right.
So he didn't get to be president. But I think he did get to be Secretary of State.
Yes, he did. He did.
This is way back in Washington's administration.
Yeah, right. But the whole point is that George Soros is in the news this week, and it ties in with what we're talking about, because Mr. Soros decided to give an interview to the Atlantic Monthly, to a writer for the Atlantic by the name of John Arledge. And in that and this is also shows in Newsweek's magazine as well, John Arledge basically did a long interview with George Soros where Soros talked about a number of things, including the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which is going on right now, where all the big money players around the world get together and talk about how they're going to spend our money. But what he really got into was looking at this whole situation with the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street, and all of the other things that have spun off from that, and basically saying that, and this is George Soros, this is what he said. He says, "I'm not here to cheer you up. The situation is about as serious and difficult as I've experienced in my career. We're facing an extremely difficult time, comparable in many ways to the 1930s, the Great Depression. We are facing now a general retrenchment in the developed world, which threatens to put us in a decade of more stagnation or worse. The best case scenario is a deflationary environment. The worst case scenario is a collapse of the financial system." Now, I think the reason why Soros is now worried about this, he didn't have any problem profiting off of it.
No.
Including Black Wednesday, where he made $1 billion in one day off of betting against the British currency. But now, if the entire financial system collapses, where's George Soros?
Well, hold on. Betting against or manipulating.
Well, it's manipulating,
It's sort of like betting against a certain horse and making sure that the horse that you bet for got a stimulant. And that's more of the, he cheats.
Yeah, well, that's true. But the key thing that created a lot of attention from this interview that he gave was that he spoke out about the Occupy movement in the United States.
Which he's funding.
Well, that was, you anticipated me again, Charles. You see, George Soros has a number of front foundations. His main foundation is called the Open Society Institute, and they put a lot of money into a lot of left-leaning things like MoveOn.org and others that our listeners would be familiar with. But the key point is that there was one that the Open Society Institute, they write checks to another group called the Tides Center, which is also a Soros front group. See, this is called money laundering, ladies and gentlemen. When you don't want people to know or not have an easy time of figuring out where the money's directly coming from. So Soros gets his money, puts it into the Open Society Institute. The Open Society then donates it to the Tides Foundation, or the Tides Center, which is a clearinghouse for donors. Then they mix it all up, and then they turn around and write it out to people like Acorn, MoveOn.org, and others. Well, it seems that over the last few years, they've been writing some nice big checks to a group called Adbusters, which is based in Canada. But it's a company, and they have a newsletter that are specifically anti-capitalist in their nature. Adbusters is notorious for being the organization that came up with the idea of Occupy Wall Street. They're the ones who pushed intellectually into the left the idea that the banks are too big and the 1% are getting, the 1% are taking over the 99%. They actually were the spark that created Occupy Wall Street. Now, again, totally funded, or not totally funded, but heavily funded by grants from the Tide Center was Adbusters, which was this company that got the Occupy movement going. Now here comes George Soros, who's acting as if he's totally away from the Occupy movement, that his fingerprints aren't on it anywhere, although people who've done the work have tracked the money.
Right.
Basically saying that the Occupy movement is going to turn violent. And it's going to create, because he says, and I quote him, that although people have reason to be frustrated and angry at the cost of rescuing the banking system, that Occupy Wall Street is an inchoate, leaderless manifestation of protest And, quote, it has put on the agenda issues that the institutional left has failed to put on the agenda for a quarter of a century. So, in other words, I couldn't, through all my other normal channels, get the left to do this. So we decided to do it by getting up a bunch of people and getting them emotionally stirred up and then foisting protest. He's now saying that Occupy could very well and likely turn violent. Now, that's a theme you've heard on our program before, because we've talked about what we see potentially coming in the spring.
This coming year, yes.
That he's saying that as anger rises, riots on the streets of American cities are inevitable. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is the man whose billions of dollars are funding the streams that are flowing right to the Occupy movement.
That's right. They're buying the soup kitchens. They're buying the tents. They're making certain that everybody can continue to stay on site. That just, of course, because the weather's cold, a lot of people have gone home. But your hardcore guys are still sitting out there with the tents and the rats and, you know, the porta potties and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And if anybody knows what's going to happen, it's the guy who's writing the checks to the foundations.
To keep it going.
To keep it. Now, it's not just about a matter. This almost sounds too passive, Barry, that these Tide foundations and these groups, thinkprogress.org and moveon.org and all these places, are just supplying good money and goods. They're not really giving them any ideas.
Oh, no. They're These groups are coordinating groups.
Of course they are.
You know, you can go and you can look up, Google up Occupy Wall Street, or use whatever browser you want, since Google's now said that they're going to track and hold every piece of information that somebody ever uses on their system. I would say get off of Google and go to other browsers like Mozilla Firefox and get yourself other search engines.
The problem being that they're, well, whatever.
That
they're,
most of them are interconnected.
They're all
that's the
all
problem.
The same critter, yeah.
But see, here's where Soros, it wasn't enough, because anybody could have guessed that, okay, with enough pushing and prodding and promises of dollars, you can get a bunch of unemployed and under-focused college students and old leftists to try to foment rebellion and get back to their vision of the 60s. But here's where Soros takes it another step. He's almost happy about this idea that there's going to be unrest, because he said, now here it is, the response to the unrest could be more damaging than the violence itself. He says, quote, it will be an excuse for cracking down and using strong-arm tactics to maintain law and order. He doesn't quite use the term martial law, Charles, but what he's saying is if it's carried to an extreme, could bring about a, quote, repressive political system.
Uh-huh.
A society where individual liberty is much more constrained, which would be a break with the tradition of the United States. Now, ladies and gentlemen, before you think that George Soros is sitting there wringing his hands and concerned about the United States, he has spent the vast majority of his adult political and financial career trying to bring down the tradition of the United States. His whole Open Society Institute is an attack against United States nationalism. That we need to have, everything needs to be totally open so that there's free flow of money and information so he can make lots of more money on it.
Well, listen to this. He sympathizes with the Occupy movement, which articulates a widespread disillusionment with capitalism that he shares. Barry.
Yes.
How did he become a multi-billionaire?
Capitalism.
By capital. And not only that, but one thing, as Christians, we are Christian capitalists, not unfettered, unbridled pagan capitalists. And there is a difference. Capitalism that has no Christian worldview behind it is just as bad as socialism, which openly rejects the Christian worldview. The fact is that Soros is one of these guys. He has no ethical system whatsoever.
No, well, his only ethical system is forming the world in his
image,
conceptualization.
That's
and image.
Right.
You see, this is all about setting himself up to be the coordinator of everything. Now, if you think I'm going too far and I'm being hyperbolic, do a little research on George Soros. He has specifically been strategic and tactical with where he puts his money. Now, he'll say, I don't get involved in party politics, but he spent a lot of money on the United States Democratic Party. And he tries to, in this article, distance himself from his direct involvement with Barack Obama. But I believe if you take a very close look, you can see that he very much was invested through his various laundering organizations to getting money to the Obama machine, whether it be through Acorn, MoveOn.org, Think Progress, all of these other ones. There's definitely been a theme and a direction that George Soros has gotten. Now he's orchestrating or sending the signal for the next phase of the drama that's unfolding in this country. And we've picked it up. We've told you about it before. The Occupy movement is not just a throwaway. It is these are the frontline pawns in a larger chess game.
Yes, exactly. This is the way that all you got to do is get 60 style riots going, and people will begin to clamor for some sort of relief. And that relief will be some form of martial law.
And that's usually what we're going to get to. And with that, we will also get to now going to be former Governor Bev Perdue in North Carolina, because she announced this week that she's not going to seek re-election because their poll numbers are just horrible and they're not coming out of the pit.
Yeah, she's likely to pull 22% of the vote.
And as we told you before, Bev Perdue was the North Carolina Democratic governor who floated the idea about suspending congressional elections because of the economy.
Yes.
Well, she's not going to run again because that, along with a number of her other strong-arm tactics, didn't work well with North Carolinians. But the key is, if we have a situation where the people clamor for, well, we need peace and security against these Occupy protesters, and they declare martial law, well, they'll get there. It's just one other means in order to keep our constitutional republic from doing the job that it's going to be doing, probably in the next election cycle, which is recentering things. We've drifted way far to the left now with the current administration, and our tendency politically in this country is we hate to be out of balance. We'll stand it for a little while, but then we'll drift back, and then we'll swing to the other side and we'll drift back. This is going to be the off-year congressional election showed a massive swing away from the Obama administration. Now we get the chance to have a referendum on everything Obama coming up in 2012, and that's something that the administration just doesn't want to see happen.
Well, and okay, but here's the problem: the candidates that are lined up on the other side are just as bad in a different way.
Well, honestly, though, Chuck, let's not get into this, because remember, we're only looking at February.
That's true.
You still could have another candidate show up on the horizon, and I think that the Republican Party is a little worried about that right now.
Well,
I've heard some rumbling out there that they're concerned because I think a poll showed that 38% of the voting populace that identify themselves as Republicans nationwide don't like any of the candidates.
That's right. And the fact is, I've already heard rumors about Mitch Daniels. And I hate to tell you this, folks, but Mitch Daniels is not the savior. He's a guy who has no problem with appointing Indiana Supreme Court justices who openly, wantonly, and easily basically say that the Fourth Amendment doesn't exist in Indiana.
That's right, and that's happened.
That has already happened there, and basically, they even the court decision in Indiana basically said, yes, we understand that we are wiping out 1,000 years of English common law and saying that the Magna Carta no longer counts, but that's what we're doing. We don't need that kind of leadership in this country, and that's exactly what we've got already, so why would we want to switch parties and get the same thing?
But honestly, folks, as we close today, these things are concerning, but these will change when you get engaged, when you learn your rights and your responsibilities, you understand our constitutional form of government, and you start educating others around you. Now, there's a class that's just started in the Canal Winchester area on Institute on the Constitution, and go to our website at principlepolicy.com to get more information on that and to possibly sign up. They've just started. Next Wednesday is going to be their second week, so you can still get in and get involved in that. We'll be announcing more classes as they're being launched over the spring. We hope that you will join us somewhere in the near future for an Institute on the Constitution class so you can learn more about our Constitution and how to utilize it to protect and defend our liberties.
And please be in a Bible-believing church tomorrow, and please say a prayer for the United States of America, the world, and be with us again for another Principles and Policies.